It's possible that you are still sending some of your money off every month to help pay off the money you borrowed to go to college. You are not alone, not by a long shot. Americans owe a lot of money for their higher education, more than $1 trillion at last count. We did not get here overnight, obviously. But if you're wondering how we did get here over time, today's guests have lots of information for you. Joel Best and Eric Best, father and son, respectively, wrote a book called The Student Loan Mess: How Good Intentions Created a $1 trillion Problem. Joel Best is a professor of sociology and criminal justice at the University of Delaware and the author of several other books. Joel Best, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having us.
Eric Best is assistant professor of emergency management at Jacksonville State University. Eric, welcome to you.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here.
So, Eric, you actually worked at a bank. Any direct connection to student loan decisions? I'm just curious.
Not really student loan decisions. Back when I was in that industry, the popular asset-backed security was actually mortgage debt. And so I learned a lot about, you know, using mortgages to securitize other risky assets. And what I found is that after I went to graduate school and I kept up with my former coworkers, mortgages were increasingly being thrown out of favor for debt security for what are called SLABs, which are student loan asset-backed securities. And so I got very interested understanding that the world that I used to be involved in was now intimately related to student loans.
So it's the same sort of thing as with mortgage loans, where they're all sort of packaged up and then sliced and diced into little pieces for various people to buy chunks of?
Exactly.
Oh, wow. I guess we didn't know that. First of all, gentlemen, you lay out not one but four student loan messes, stretching back how far in time?
Well, we go back to 1958, which is when the National Defense Education Act was passed. And that was a reaction to Sputnik. There was a big panic that American schools had failed, and we needed to do something. And there was a bill passed that did a lot of things. But one of the things it did was it established a student loan program for people in what we now call STEM disciplines, science, engineering, mathematics. And the idea was that, you know, the government was going to support the education of the future scientists that would help us catch up in the space race. By 1965, Lyndon Johnson passes another bill, the Higher Education Act, and by this time, the whole idea of catching up with the Russians has disappeared, and it's just the notion that every kid in the United States, every talented kid, ought to be able to have the money to go to college, and the government will help him get loans. So that's kind of the first mess, and you know, can we make sure that we aren't wasting brain power? By the 1970s, the focus has really shifted to what we call a second mess, which is the idea that there are deadbeats, that the students are failing to pay back their loans, and that this is really a big problem. And we worry about that until the 1990s, when they pass a law that basically makes it impossible to discharge your student loans through bankruptcy. By then, people are starting to worry about what we call the third mess, which is, you know, crippling debt, terrible debt burdens, tens, even hundreds of thousands of dollars of student loan debt. And then around the time that the Great Recession kicked in, people started worrying about the prospect of for-profit institutions being a bubble. Now, that kind of brings the story up to date, but there are obviously future messes on the horizon, and part of what we're trying to suggest is that we would be better off if we'd look at the big picture instead of focusing on one aspect at a time.
So, Eric, the basic thesis here is that these programs are meant to make college affordable, but they had some unintended consequences?
Right, exactly. You know, and every time that we focus on an overly specific aspect of college costs or student lending, we feel good about addressing a very small problem while college costs continue to go up, and that means that, you know, debt is going to continue to go up.
All right, so Joel, you take the story back two generations before you. Did your grandfather go to college?
My grandfather did not. He wanted to go to college. He was a farm boy in a remote corner of North Dakota. And my great-grandfather got sick, and he was the oldest son, and he had to take over the farm. He had to give up college because college was just too far away. He and his wife, my grandparents, you know, tried to drive their children to college. My dad was not particularly with that program, but he got drafted, fought in the Second World War, and after the war married my mother, and she twisted his arm and convinced him to go to school on the GI Bill.
And so you did set aside money for your own kids, and how far did that go?
Well, it went quite a ways. Part of the good news was that I teach at a university where faculty children go for very little cost. And even though we'd set aside what we thought was a lot of money, by the time you buy computers and if you want to live on campus and pay for books and so on, a fair pile of money goes away pretty fast.
All right. We'll talk more about the individual circumstances of some of the people we're talking about here, but the broader implications of the student loan mess, as outlined in the book by Joel Best and Eric Best. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with the Bests and with your phone calls and emails as well when we return in a minute 30. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking today about student loans, and in particular how we got to where we are today with student loans in America, where the overall debt load is more than $1 trillion in money owed for paying for higher education. This is a situation detailed in the book, The Student Loan Mess, by the father and son writing team of Joel Best, a sociologist, and Eric Best, an economist. You can join our discussion on the exchange. Maybe you still have student loans. Maybe you have student loans you're helping your kids pay back, or your kids have student loans. Let's hear the story from you and how deep you might have gotten in. 800-838-3760 around the region. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782 by email jx@jeffnet.org. We were just talking about Joel setting aside money for the kids, and that includes you, Eric. Eric, how did you pay for graduate school?
So I for a first year, I actually took out student loans. I was boxed into an interesting situation where I was working before. I made too much money to get any assistance, and I did not have a funded assistantship. And I wanted to go to graduate school so badly that I just decided to pay for the first year. And, you know, that year of school would have just about wiped out my savings. And so I took a look at federal direct loans and realized that I could get a loan under what, at the time, were fairly generous terms. And so I decided to pay for a first year of school with student loans. And then after that, I did well enough to get an assistantship. So I was very lucky as a graduate student.
It's interesting you made the comparison. You looked at your savings and went, okay, I want to leave those alone, so I'll get the loan anyway. I have heard stories, and I don't know how common this was back at the time that I was going to college, which would have been in the early 80s, of people who would get the student loans because they had a lower interest rate to pay back, and then take the money from those and put them into a certificate of deposit, which was paying pretty well in savings accounts at that time. Have you heard other stories like that, Eric?
Yes, and the 1980s, which was a, you know, high inflation, high interest period, was a very different situation now. And, you know, now interest rates for deposit savings are so low that we actually have the opposite problem, where people trying to save for college actually just get further and further behind because tuition is rising faster than savings. For anybody that's interested in this, on our website, which is studentloanmess.com, last week I actually did an analysis of what it would take to save up for state school. And my back-of-the-envelope calculation is that saving for a child about to be born just to pay for a state school would take 22 years of savings of $600 a month in you know, savings accounts or certificates of deposit. So it's a massive amount.
$600 a month for 22 years?
It adds up.
Wow. So you'd really have to start saving 4 years before you had that kid.
Yeah.
Wow. That's amazing. With you know, given that the two of you have different training, Eric and Joel, Eric the economist, Joel the sociologist. Joel, did you end up getting to some points of disagreement on the causes of the student loan mess?
No, I don't think that was the case, but I certainly learned a lot. you know, my experience with borrowing money was basically making house payments. And at one point I wrote something and I was kind of confused, and Eric read it and said, you don't really understand this that well, do you? So his having worked in the bank really added a lot. And I think we educated each other. So it wasn't a conflict, but it was a sense where each of us brought different strengths to this. And that was a good thing.
You share with us in the book some of the key assumptions driving our system of student loans, starting with number one, which is that higher education is a good thing. Joel, what are some of the other assumptions we make here about the student loans?
Well, we think everybody ought to be able to go to school. We think that they ought to be able to choose where they go to school if they can get in. We think that they ought to be able to study whatever they want to study. And all of this has consequences. It's, you know, I'm absolutely in favor of higher education and giving people access to higher education, but having student loans has consequences. It produces a certain amount of bad behavior on the part of students. It produces really bad behavior on the part of colleges and also on the part of state legislatures, so that a lot of students stop being very price sensitive. They aren't really thinking that this is their money. They're saying to themselves, I'm going to have to borrow a lot of money. If I go to College A, if I go to College B, which I'd really prefer, I have to borrow a little bit more. What's the difference? Go right ahead. So you're not paying attention to the ticket. Colleges have taken that price insensitivity and said, well, great, if our customers don't care what we're charging, we can raise prices very dramatically, and the costs of higher education have gone up not just faster than the cost of living, they've gone up faster than the cost of health care. This is a tremendous increase. And the third thing that's happened is that state legislatures have begun to shift responsibility so that, for example, when I was a student in Minnesota, I went to the University of Minnesota, it cost me $75 a quarter. And that was essentially a free education. The state legislature was basically saying, we're going to give our in-state students what amounts to a free education, and then they're going to become taxpayers and we'll get the money back. These days, the legislators are saying to themselves, you know, we've got other kinds of expenses that we have to pay for. We don't really need to support students as much as we used to because they can go get loans. So loans have kind of, you know, we have the same assumptions, but loans have changed the playing field.
But you're talking to two states here where a lot of the mechanism there was a sharp reduction in property taxes that required the state to provide some services that were not being provided at the local level anymore, primarily to schools. And in Oregon's case, prisons as well, with a higher sentencing measure. So a lot of money that would have been otherwise going into public higher education left and moved on to other parts of the state.
Oh, absolutely. And Medicaid is the other thing. Prisons and Medicaid have been gobbling up a growing share of state budgets.
All right. So the point being that it's more than just price insensitivity based on the part of the students. Okay.
Yeah.
When you write in the book that the higher education system has come to resemble our health care system, how do you mean that, Eric Best?
What we mean is that in the U.S. we have a health insurance system now where price is almost completely decoupled from service. In the, if you and I and Joel all go to a different hospital today and ask for an identical service, we're going to be billed three amounts of money that are just almost completely unrelated. And then our insurance companies will duke it out with the hospitals to decide what's ultimately paid. And so when you take the consumer out of the pricing equation, we no longer have the ability to accurately compare services. And college is becoming very similar in that, you know, President Obama has been trying to make a total cost of education calculator, which has just been a disaster because schools don't present costs in a consistent way. So you have some schools that have student fees that are $25 a year. You have a lot of schools now that have student fees that are thousands of dollars a year. And so, you know, if you just look at tuition and you don't count housing, meal plans, fees, course fees, so on and so forth, it becomes very difficult to directly compare costs.
So they all call them something different, and they charge them in different ways.
Yes.
Yeah, I remember that, come to think of it. At the University of Missouri, there was the incidental fee that everybody paid. That could be a couple hundred bucks, but there was also the tuition on top of that for the out-of-state students.
Yes.
Which got pretty big. So what were the—now, you mentioned 1958 with the National Defense Education Act, the Sputnik spawn thing, but there were people going to college on the GI Bill before that, weren't there?
Oh, absolutely. But that was the government gave them money. That was the thanks of the graceful nations. That was not a loan program.
Okay.
It was a different philosophy. Notice that when we started this, there used to be a lot more money that went to low-income students in particular in the form of Pell Grants. Pell Grants are still a big program, but the amount of your education that you can cover through a Pell Grant has declined. You're going to have to get money from other sources as well. And what's happened is that we've sort of gone away from the idea that, hey, let's provide an essentially free education and we'll get the money back in taxes. And instead, we've gone to let's pay as you go and have the students finance their own education. Now, you know, both of those are you can make either choice, but the choices have consequences. That's why, you know, Oregon right now is as we understand it, toying with the idea of doing something very different, basically allowing students to go for free.
It is something being discussed at the moment, and obviously it's still very much in the preliminary stages. We're talking to Joel Best and Eric Best about their book, The Student Loan Mess. They are father and son. Joel's a sociologist. Eric is an economist. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about student loans and the high cost of education generally and how we get all this to match up and how we might fix it. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Just to be very obvious here, Eric Best, the cost end of things, I mean, obviously college costs more now. Is it that much larger as a percent of median income?
Oh, absolutely.
Sure, yeah.
And not only is cost a larger percentage of income, but cost that's not covered by federal loans is becoming a larger percentage of income. A couple generations ago, for even private schools, federal loans could cover about half of cost of attendance, and these days they'll cover less than a quarter. And so, you know, families are just being simply outpaced by tuition growth.
We talked about the growth generation by generation of people going to college, Joel Best. Mm-hmm. So, for example, with the National Defense Education Act and then 7 years later the Higher Education Act, I mean, were larger chunks of the population going to college? Did it come to be an expectation for the majority of people in America?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. 100 years ago, about, 3-4% of the population was graduating from college. Today, among young people, it'll be close to 30%, the graduates. And you'll have that many more who've attended college for some length of time and haven't graduated yet. These days a majority of young people get some sort of higher education.
Were loans themselves a little tricky to get across to people as a way to do this? Because, I mean, obviously we got used to the idea over time of getting out long-term loans for our houses and not-so-long-term loans for our cars. But was the idea of a loan for education something, obscene or something back in the 1920s or something?
Well, that was actually one of the reasons that we got interested in writing the book, is that you see from the post-World War II period into the 80s into today an almost complete shift into debt financing for, you know, houses, then vehicles, then educations, then credit cards. And, nowadays it's so much easier for an average consumer to get into debt than it was a generation or especially two generations ago. If you consider that a credit card was something very rare for a college student a generation ago, and, you know, now there's legislation to stop them from being too bombarded with credit today, you can really see the difference in credit access in the United States.
Well, you know, you mentioned the back-of-the-envelope calculation that these days to go to a public college, you'd have to save up $600 a month for 22 years to pay for a child to go to college. What was the... What's the projection? Oh, man, I lost my train of thought here. Sorry about that. Looking for... all right, it'll come to me. I'll move on to the next question then. In the process of explaining the student loan messes, you show that 1971 was the first year that there were $1 billion in new loans. By 1986, $10 billion in new student loans. At some point along the way, did somebody say out loud, hey, maybe not all these people are college material?
That really isn't something that people are too eager to say. I think that there's the sense that national well-being requires educating a large share of the population, and what we do is we let everybody start college and see if they can make it through. And sometimes you'll get commentators that are outraged that not everybody finishes, but that's always been the way. I mean, you anticipate that some students are going to go, and you'll have some students that were very good students in high school, and they'll crash and burn in college for one reason or another. But you'll also have many more people who weren't particularly good high school students for one reason or another, and they kind of catch on. They're late bloomers. And I don't think that people want to really cut those people off from opportunity. So we tend to say, okay, come on, you can try this out. I think there are risks in this. One of the risks is that if you have kind of predatory colleges that are really trying to attract applications from people who are very, very unlikely to succeed, that becomes a problem. But I think that, I'm not bothered by the idea that some people go to college and it turns out that it isn't for them.
Because at least they tried?
Yes. And additionally, one of the cultural issues in the United States is that higher education is molding into a part of the American dream, where, formerly we were concentrated on home ownership, and we've really gotten home ownership up to kind of the steady state level, as high as it's going to go. And now we focus on higher education. And, you can just imagine, as a politician, running on a platform of decreased home ownership and decreased access to education. And, in our system, that's just something that's not going to happen.
Not a winning campaign.
Right.
No. Okay, I can remember what the other question was. You were talking about 22 years, $600 a month to afford to send the child to state school. Of the people who actually do have loans now, what's the usual period of time in which they're repaying those?
That depends. There are a couple payment programs. There's a for federal loans. There's a standard repayment program of 10 years. There's an extended repayment program of 25 years. And then there's income-based repayment and pay-as-you-earn, which is becoming increasingly popular. And President Obama is actually going to issue an executive order increasing access to this in a couple hours today. But that program is also a 25-year repayment period. And so as you see more people transitioning away from standard repayment, you're getting into repayment plans that last 25 years, which, for a fair portion of college graduates means that they'll still be repaying their loans as they're sending children to college.
Oh, yeah, far and away, easily. Let's talk about the terminology used a few minutes ago, Joel Best, about predatory colleges.
Mm-hmm.
Who would those be?
Well, I don't want to equate for-profit institutions with predatory colleges, but certainly there are perfectly reputable for-profit institutions, but certainly you've got some of the very large for-profit institutions, which are accountable to their shareholders. They're forced to. If they're going to increase profits, they're basically going to have to increase enrollment. And so you have all of these ads on late-night TV and so on and so forth. We have a friend who is involved in social services for the disabled, and she's told me that she's had literally dozens of clients with IQs in the 80-75 range who have found themselves solicited, wouldn't you like to go to college? Our university will help you sign up, and it's not going to cost you anything because you're going to fill out these loan forms and you can go. And of course, these are people that have, you know, very, very remote prospects of even completing the first course. But after they've signed up, they will have student loans to repay. And they're not going to get one of those fabulous jobs that's going to allow them to repay those loans.
All right. So the point is not to educate people. It is to make money because it is a for-profit operation.
It's a for-profit. Yeah. And you can run for-profit education responsibly, but you don't have to.
All right, we'll talk more about the whole situation with the for-profit schools and the student loan mess. The Student Loan Mess is the name of the book by Joel Best and Eric Best. Back with the Best and with your phone calls and emails in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guests today are the father and son authoring team of Joel and Eric Best. Joel is a sociologist. Eric is an economist. They have written a book together called The Student Loan Mess, How Good Intentions Created a $1 trillion Problem. Yes, it was in 2012 that we realized there were $1 trillion in student loans still outstanding in America. You can join our discussion on the exchange about how we got here and perhaps how we get out of it. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So we were just talking about for-profit education, Joel. Is the value of an education from a place like, to name names, the University of Phoenix, less than from, say, Arizona State University?
Well, I make less money on average when they graduate.
Really? Really? That much less?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's... you know, the real problem with a for-profit education is not you'll make slightly less money if you get a degree than if you go to a traditional not-for-profit school. But the real problem is that the vast majority of students that go into the for-profit schools don't graduate. They don't leave with a degree. So that at a not-for-profit school, you have more than half of the students are going to get a degree within 6 years. At major for-profit institutions, it's less than a quarter.
It has been pointed out that the for-profit schools for decades now have managed to make some pretty good friends in Congress. What has been the effect there? I mean, what sorts of legislation have passed that have helped out the for-profit colleges?
Well, I think the biggest thing that has helped them out, and this gets a little wonky, so I'm going to apologize.
It's okay.
But veterans benefits actually count against student loan limits. So the United States has limits, which is currently called the 90-10 rule, which is that no more than 90% of your income as a college can come from federal direct loans. And there's a policy now that veterans benefits actually count towards that 10% instead of the 90%. So you see just feverish competition for veterans on the part of these for-profit schools. And a lot of times that's really a disservice to the people in our armed forces because they're trying to do classes while they're deployed and they're getting aggressively recruited, and they're ending up not being served very well because they don't have the internet connections, the time, and the ability to complete school in the time frame that they're being offered to do it.
Well, then it also seems like getting adjustments made to that figure 90-10 could make a big difference in the profit margin for a for-profit college.
Yes, it would, and there's proposals to change that to the 85-15 rule. But changing that would mean that a lot of the largest for-profit schools would already be in violation.
All right, so let's come back to the sort of the middle of the picture here, because you're describing in the book four distinct student loan messes somewhere between two and three, let's say. By the 1980s, had it gotten to the point where, as with a lot of programs, it wasn't just this shiny, new, cool thing, but it was something that everybody just sort of took for granted? Everybody expected to have student loans out there that they could get fairly cheaply?
Well, this increases gradually. It's only in the last 10 years that most students have student loans, but the percentage has been increasing very dramatically, and partly it's increasing because, as we're saying, the cost of education is going up so dramatically that it becomes harder and harder for, students working part-time jobs, families saving money, et cetera, to put together enough money to cover the cost of education.
Just on basic supply and demand levels, and Joel, I know you mentioned earlier that the fact is that it became a lot less price sensitive. As with a lot of things, when you got a credit card in your hand, it's like, oh, well, yeah, I'll take that, as opposed to looking very carefully at the price. So Eric, just in simple economist supply and demand terms, I mean, are the numbers at colleges rising rapidly because there are so many people willing to go to college?
I think there's people willing to go. There's also pressure to go. You know, a generation ago, you could earn a perfectly respectable living by doing a trade. And, you know, nowadays, whether or not this is true, what we're told, in you know, all the way from elementary school through college, is that it's higher education or bust. And so I think there's tremendous incentive on the parts of consumers to get higher education. And, you know, most of them are going to end up being better served by a higher education, but certainly not all. And those that start but don't finish, so that they have the debt payments but don't have the degree, are really the ones that are left in the worst spot.
All right. Well, okay. You get to this on page 131. Is college worth it? I mean, do the two of you answer that question the same way?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. So
yes, we agree, and yes, it's worth it.
Right. Of course, you both work at colleges too. I suppose that might color your thinking a little bit, right?
Well, it does. But I think that what you need to understand is it's worth it if you finish. It's particularly worth it if you. Manage your expenses so that you're minimizing your debt. It's particularly worth it if you have a plan for what you're going to do with your education so that you're pretty sure you're marketable later. I think that you can borrow just about as much money as you want if you want an engineering degree and you're going to finish the program. If you're going to study the humanities, you might want to think more carefully about how much you want to borrow.
Of course, you know, we come back to the subtitle of the book, which is about how good intentions created a trillion-dollar problem. Should the number alone be a source of concern to us? I mean, because we've heard many times the same sort of thing about the federal deficit, the national debt, the accumulated national debt, you know, several trillion dollars. It's $14 trillion or something and north of that now. Should the number alone scare us about student loans and the amount owed, given the size of the population, et cetera?
I'll let Eric answer this, but what would scare me is it's going to be $2 trillion in 2020.
Yeah, the number alone is not scary, but what's really scary is the delinquency rate. And one of the things that we always mention is that during the peak of the mortgage crisis, about 1 in 10 mortgages were in default, meaning that 90% of people were still paying their loans on time. And in student loans now, we have over a third of graduates that should be paying back their loans that aren't for one reason or another. And so when you have a big amount of outstanding debt and you have a huge proportion of people that aren't paying back their loans, you have all of the recipes for a crisis.
Let us take some calls. We have Gordon in Medford on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Eric Best and Joel Best, the authors of The Student Loan Mess.
Hi. I thought you might be interested to know that there's a local company that benefits significantly from there being a lot of student loans out. In Grants Pass, there's a company called DCS, which stands for Diversified Collection Services, which is one of the largest collection agencies that specifically focuses on student loans. And, boy, let me tell you, those guys can be kind of rough on people who owe money. They'll call them up and say, we're going to take your house and your car and your boat and give them a day or two to sit and stew. And then they'll call them up and say, hey, how'd you like to talk to us about a repayment plan?
Huh, okay.
I thought you'd find that interesting.
All right, so a collection agency. I hadn't even thought about that angle of things before. Eric, I imagine there's quite a few of those in the business.
Oh, there absolutely are, and this is actually a great time to bring up Senator Elizabeth Warren, who actually comes into this conversation for a number of reasons, the first being the development of the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, which created a lot of restrictions for collectors. And the second being that she has a proposal in the Senate to allow students to roll private former student loan debt into federal direct loans, which would essentially stop collections. And so if that plan ends up passing, that's going to be bad times for a lot of those collection agencies, and probably good times for a lot of the former borrowers, because there are a lot of collection agencies that are very clearly overstepping their bounds.
So these would cease to be private loans and become public loans.
Right.
Federal loans. Got it. Okay, let's take a call from Jacob and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about the student loan mess.
Hi. There's a saying in economics that the cure for high prices is high prices. And when you have college tuition approaching per year at private institutions, $50,000 or $60,000 or $75,000, you know, if you go to a private Ivy League school, pretty soon that amount is so much that it's actually a pretty decent salary for a postdoctoral graduate student. You know, and so if I could, you know, the ultimate education is probably a one-on-one tutoring. You know, that's what Kings receive, the professors receive. And what I'm proposing is colleges are going to price themselves out, because, you know, if it becomes so expensive to go to college and I could hire a postdoctorate student in, you know, computer programming for $75,000 and get one-on-one tutoring for a whole year, you know, pretty soon. Or I could do that for, like, language skills, or for, like, any type of sub-discipline. And there's a lot of unemployed graduates. And I'm saying these could be literally maybe thousands of jobs where people could actually be private tutors. And actually, the student would get a pretty good education on a one-on-one tutor basis.
Okay, we got a pretty good...
Some of the best graduate students.
I sense a response already on that, but thanks for the call, Jacob.
I like the idea, you know, the best school is a teacher on one end of the log and a student on the other. I think the problem is that as our society is based on the idea of credentialing. And so I'm not sure that, you know, if Sam teaches everything he knows to a student, that the student's isn't necessarily going to be able to take that out and exchange it for what he can get for a diploma.
Let's take another call. Here's Nick in Lolita. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with the Bests.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah, the comment by your speaker about craftsmanship and learning a trade, I think, is undervalued. If you know how to build a house, you know how to grow your food, you know how to pipe water, you know how to run electrical, you know how to do plumbing, the student loan deal is not reality, because you already are a craftsman.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's get a response. Thanks for that, Nick. Appreciate you standing up for craftsmen. Was that what you meant? I think it was Eric who mentioned the thing about trades.
Yes, absolutely. You know, if you're 18 years old and you're having an honest conversation with yourself, and you realize that college isn't for you, and you decide instead to continue with vocational school or become an apprentice, say electrician or something like that, you can end up having a very nice life. Now that still requires quite a bit of work. You know, you wouldn't want to not go to school and focus on retail or something like that. But there are certainly students that would be better served by learning a trade that are pressured into continuing higher education. And part of the problem is that it's not our job as professors or policy wonks to tell those students who they are. It kind of needs to become a self-selection issue. But again, if we could give, you know, an honest picture of what a wage is going to look like as a craftsman, what it's going to cost to go to college, that might allow those students to make a more informed choice.
All right, let's make some assumptions here in the last couple of minutes, which is, one would be that as long as the economy continues to create jobs relatively slowly, I know there was a pickup in the last report, but as long as the jobs are not created that fast, it seems like the backlog of people with loans would only grow, wouldn't it?
Absolutely.
All right. So, and if jobs are created slowly, obviously tax revenue grows slowly, requiring public institutions in particular to keep raising tuition because they get less public money over time. So this is sort of a self-worsening cycle, isn't it?
Yes, we're in a bit of a downward spiral as far as educational costs.
So are there some remedies listed in the student loan mess?
Do you want to take that?
Well, yeah, I think that we... argue, first of all, that you don't have one thing that you want to do. You have to have a set of things. The single most important thing is to get college costs under control. But there are also things that the government can do. There are things that legislators can do. There are things that families can do. You know, I think that what you want to do is minimize educational debt to the degree that you can. And, you know, for some people that's going to be very difficult. For others, it may be more feasible.
Well, I know about Baumol's cost disease. You can't do the minute waltz in 45 seconds. You can't teach a one-hour lecture in 45 minutes. So, I mean, essentially, you do have some costs that are going to continue to spiral, don't you, Eric?
Yes. You know, you're never going to get higher education costs down to zero. But, you know, one of the very unpopular but practical things you could do is change higher education to focus on higher education. You know, cut out the focus on athletics and on services and things like that, because a very high proportion of the cost increases are due to administration, sometimes through regulation, sometimes through college competition, you know, and basically features outside of the classroom and instruction. So you have a rise in instructional costs, and then you have an even larger rise in non-instructional costs. And focusing on both of those things will help us get costs under control.
Whole lot to think about in the book, The Student Loan Mess, How Good Intentions Created a Trillion-Dollar Problem. Joel Best, Eric Best, its authors. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
Tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about a program to get the two sides and the forest problem together and getting some timber to mills in eastern Oregon. We'll talk about a birthday for Lake Shasta Caverns as well. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duran, our student assistant, Megan Mercier. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening and have a great day.